Hello and welcome to Russians with Attitude. You are listening to us just in time for the launch of a new, very special historical series based in Russia. Each episode of Based in Russia will be dedicated to an exciting event of Russian history. We are planning to cover various topics: Russian Civil War, Russian Revolution, Wrangel, Kolchak, Stolypin, Russo-Japanese War, Time of the Troubles, Constitutional Crisis of the 90s, any topic of high interest that only we can bring to your attention in a podcast form and the right attitude. Think Radio War Nerd, but Russian and based. Dear listener, please pour yourself a cup of hot cocoa. Are you actually saying cocoa instead of cacao? I don't know. Do they say that?
Cocoa. Because I think.
Cocoa? But Yandex Translator has tricked me. Okay, cocoa. Fire up your fireplace. Pet your cat. Because today's topic will be the great game. The struggle between Russians and the British in High Asia. Wild adventures, British spies, Asian hunts, Russian officers and the rule of intrigue. What more can you ask? So, Kirill, we have been motivated to make this episode by a certain book, The Great Game by Peter Hopkirk, a British historian and a journalist. So, is the author's identity relevant in this case, or could we call his work mostly free from bias?
When I read it, it was surprisingly unbiased. It's clear that Peter Hopkirk was extremely interested, like from an academic point of view, in this topic. And I think his work as a journalist, he traveled a lot. He has been to many of the cities and mountain passes he writes about. So he knows the topic intimately. And yeah, I think it's a pretty fair book. He writes because he studied the anti-Russian sentiments in Britain at that time, and I don't think he's very biased. It's a pretty fair representation of everything that happened. So I greatly enjoyed this book, and I can only recommend it to our listeners.
Let's clear some things up. We are gonna tell you about certain Russian great men who led the offense of the Imperial Russian colonization project. And what is the difference, if there is any, between High Asia and Central Asia?
Well, High Asia describes the mountain regions. So the Himalayas, Afghanistan, the Hindu Kush. So High Asia is literally just Asia that is high up.
I see.
It's basically everything, the Great Plateau that is formed of the Hindu Kush and Himalaya. So basically between Afghanistan and Tibet and Nepal and northern India. And Central Asia is that which, basically lies between the Caspian Sea and China.
I have collected some great quotes from the book, so let me recite one of them to start off our podcast. "Where the imperial flag has once flown, Tsar Nicholas is said to have decreed, it must never be lowered. Nor did his son, Alexander, have any reason to think differently. To those serving on Russia's Asiatic frontiers, the interference soon became clear. Raise the two-headed eagle first, and ask permission afterwards. Those who did just that found that they were rarely, if ever, repudiated. This turning of a blind eye to such expropriations by St. Petersburg was to coincide with the rise of a new and aggressive breed of frontier officer. Not surprisingly, in view of their country's defeat in the Crimean War, they were Anglophobes to a man." Quite interesting, this scenario where some major generals or just officers led the charge. They decide to capture some city or territory for Mother Russia, even if they are told not to do it from the Tsar or his advisors. It really is quite unique, I think.
I think that was, in a lot of ways, the character of the Great Game, because the Great Game, it was not an, it was kind of a cold war between Britain and Russia, but it was, I think, never actively fought between, you know, Russian and British line infantry, except maybe if you regard the Crimean War as an episode in this. And yes, the game changed after the Crimean War. The beginning of the Great Game is usually dated to around 1830, when the British started becoming paranoid about Russian advances in Central Asia, because the British were afraid most of all of losing India. Actually, the beginning of the Great Game can be traced even back to the Napoleonic Wars, when Emperor Paul I came to terms with Napoleon and even decided to send, well, basically he decided to attack British India. There was even a whole Cossack coast that was ready to march on India, but Emperor Paul was murdered right before he could give the order. Some Russian historians have even considered that he might have been assassinated by the British, that the coup d'etat that was happening was a British intrigue to stop Paul from becoming too friendly with Napoleon and trying to destroy the British Empire. So it has always been a point of contention. And in the first half of the 19th century, Russia was expanding rapidly. As Pigdog has mentioned, Nicholas I decreed that wherever the Russian flag is raised, it can never be taken down. And over the whole history of the Russian Empire, each Tsar has left his heir the country larger than it was. So Russia has expanded all the time, even with some losses in territory, especially in America, Alaska, and California. Still, under every emperor, the Russian Empire grew in size. The Crimean War was also basically an episode of the Great Game, because the British and the French, they supported the Ottoman Empire because they didn't want Russia getting access to the Mediterranean through the Dardanelles, which was basically the Russian casus belli to get access to the Dardanelles again, which were closed for Russian warships by the Ottomans. So, and after the defeat in the Crimean War, which, yeah, it was a defeat, of course, but you have also to consider that Russia was fighting the three strongest armies except itself in the world at the same time, and with outdated technology, and it still was quite not as bad as it could have been, after all. But still, it was regarded as a national shame, and the new breed of young officers who were veterans of the Crimean War, of the Caucasus Wars, of the Polish rebellions, who came after the old-fashioned officers of the Napoleonic Wars, who were still kind of caught up in the mindset that conflict only happens between line infantry under flags and drumming. These officers were a new breed, and the same happened, of course, for the British. They also had a young, ambitious officers, and this war, this Cold War, this Great Game was played by spies, by merchants, by officers who were out of uniform, traveling, pretending to be someone else, scouts, cartographers, because there were no reliable maps of the region, and so these mapping expeditions were a large part of the Great Game, and it was almost as important. You couldn't capture a city or conquer a river valley if you didn't know what it looked like. So the search for mountain passes, the mapping of bridges along rivers and so on, it was as important as any military action. This basically leads us to the situation of the mid-19th century, when after Nicholas I died and Alexander II took over as Emperor of Russia, there were a cool down in the Great Game, because Russia had to deal with the repercussions of the defeat in the Crimean War, and also Alexander wanted to start off with the social reforms, like the abolishment of serfdom and the agrarian reforms, and there was just much to think about without considering the conflict with Britain.
Regarding this new breed of aggressive, ambitious officers, one such man, a very young man, that is described in the Peter Hopkirk's book, is Officer Ignatiev, who served as a military attaché for Russian Empire in London and actively plotted against it. He also was collecting maps of British territories in Asia, and it was quite suspicious as well, because that's what everyone was doing at the time. In mid-19th century, Russia was expanding at two directions, Central Asia and East Asia at the same time. So thousands of kilometers, imperial colonial ambitions, with the British trying to sabotage every single one of them. Why exactly Ignatiev made it so high that Tsar himself listened to a 25-year-old officer?
After his work in London, he was already noticed by his superiors, and at the age of 26, he was sent to a secret mission to Central Asia. His mission was to discover British influence in the Khanates of Kiva and Bukhara, and because the British traders and agents and officers of the East India Company were very active in the region. It has to be understood that at that point, it wasn't so much the British military that was engaged in what was happening there. It was the East India Company's private forces to a large extent. Because, to be honest, the East India Company had more money to throw around. They had more experienced officers. And they were just superior in basically every way to whatever the regular British army could put up. So Ignatiev went to Khiva, and he went to Bukhara, and his mission was pretty successful. He mapped the region, he convinced the Khan of Khiva to open the market to Russian merchants.
It's interesting that Russian officers laughed a bit as British strategy of convincing tribal leaders to do as they want. He brought an organ as a gift to a Khan via RLC, that was still, I guess, alive back then. And the Brits also did that a couple centuries ago in Turkey. So maybe they were inspired by British intrigue.
Yes, of course. The Brits were the foremost masters of subterfuge, intrigue, and intelligence. And of course, you had to learn from the best to beat them. It was the Russian imperial strategy for centuries, starting with Peter the Great. Copy whatever the Europeans were doing and try to do it better and beat the Europeans at their own game. After Ignatiev's successful mission in Central Asia, he was sent to the other front of Russian colonial expansion, which we had already mentioned, to China.
Yes, Peking Showdown, where the French and the British forces, when they invaded Chinese Empire and threatened to annex it and take Peking or Beijing. So Tsar Alexander sent Ignatiev to fool all of them. Quote, the prospect of the British thus gaining a foothold in the Manchu capital struck fear into the Russians, imperial of their far eastern domains. Such was the situation when Ignatiev set out by sleigh and on horseback for distant Peking in the spring of 1859. His most urgent task was to secure the Tsar's new territories by coercing the Chinese emperor into formally ceding them to Russia, thereby making them a permanent part of the Russian Empire. It was a classic great game mission, and St. Petersburg could not have entrusted it to a more determined or resourceful player. He played off Chinese against the British and vice versa. Every time that British forces didn't move, Ignatiev pretended that he ordered them to do it. So Chinese believed that Ignatiev is capable of commanding British and French forces to capture Peking. So they accepted the Peking Treaty and gave away their territories to Russian Empire. Lord Elgin, the British commander, did momentarily toy with the idea, writing to Lord John Russell, then Foreign Secretary, "We might annex the Chinese Empire if we were in the humor to take a second India in hand." So you get the feeling that the British didn't actually want to annex Chinese Empire, that India was more than enough, considering that it was a huge pain in the ass. There were a lot of uprisings. They could barely manage that. So Ignatieff cleverly tricked the Chinese and the French and the British to some extent, and back to St. Petersburg. Actually, how long would it take to travel from St. Petersburg to Pekin by a horse? At least 3 weeks. Maybe more. I'm not sure.
It depends a bit on the route. When he, Ignatieff, was hidden and traveling as a spy, it took months. But when he could travel openly, it was a lot faster, but still around a month at least, I think, yeah.
Not since 1815, one British historian has written, had Russia concluded such an advantageous treaty, and probably never before had such a feat been carried off by so young a Russian diplomat. Political Russian elite was divided. At the time, there were hawks and soyjacks. Appointed after his Asian success, a temporary general, 27 years old Ignatieff, highly militaristic East Siberian governor general Muravyov, who captured a lot of Pacific lands for Russia, general governor of the Caucasus Buryatinsky, who crushed Chechen warlord Imam Shamil, and war minister Milutin. So they all pressured Tsar into further expansion. While soyjacks complained about economy, feared British response, and so on. Yes, and Crimean humiliation, as you said, played a big part in this resentment, and they wanted to strike back to best British at their own game and be as aggressive as needed. They also believed that the British have entered a passive state and are not as threatening as they used to be. And it was actually quite so, because when Russia made its move in 1864 with a goal to capture 500 miles of Central Asian marches, forts and cities from Hokan Khanate, the Khan was really mad when he lost all this clay, and he immediately sent an emissary to India to plead British to involve themselves to defend the Khanate against Russians. But the British politely refused and said that they believe in the doctrine of masterly inactivity that is now guiding the British policy in Central Asia. It's such a high cry from modern Britain, that, which is not really an empire, but can you believe that the British diplomat would say that they are abiding by the doctrine of masterly inactivity now, and they don't care what Russia is doing? It's ridiculous. But yes, please tell us about the assault on the Hokan Khanate in 1864.
Yes, the situation in the Central Asian Khanates around 1864-65 was pretty much looking like this. The Khanates were extremely primitive states. They were basically feudal, like early medieval level of social organization. And three city-states were ruling over most of the region: Khiva, Bukhara, and Khakand. These city-states were centered on their Khanate palaces, but they still ruled over large areas. I think it was like half of the continental United States. So a huge territory, a huge population, very important trade routes, resources, and so on. And of course, this was the way to India, and the British were deathly afraid of the Russians expanding in this region. There was, however, a rather pressing casus belli, which the Russian government could use every time. And it was that these primitive Muslim tribal states in Central Asia were slave societies. They had vessels in the form of nomadic horsemen, tribal nomadic horsemen who were staging slave raids into Russia and had been doing this for hundreds of years. And Russian slaves were openly being traded in the city-states, and the Russian government saw it as its duty and right to stop the slave trade. There were even British missions where British officers tried to convince the Khans to stop the slave trade, to deprive the Russian government of its casus belli. And the most important of these cities was Tashkent, which at that time belonged to the Khan of Khokand. It was by far the richest city in Central Asia and had a population of over 100,000, which was at that time huge for this region. It was rich in resources, it was an important trading post, and there were very interesting political situations happening in Tashkent because the merchants were mostly forming the pro-Russian party. The merchants wanted Tashkent to become Russian because they saw an opportunity to get rich by trading with the Russian traders. There were not very many British traders in the region, so they saw a Russian expansion simply as an opening up of the markets. While the conservative religious party was supportive of the Emir of Bukhara, who was the most regressive ruler of the region and had a very despotic slave society. And here enters the hero of today's episode, the Russian general Chernyayev. Chernyayev, Mikhail Grigorievich, was born in 1828 into an impoverished noble family, so he was an aristocrat, but he wasn't from a rich family. He joined the army because that's what poor nobles did in the Russian Empire, and he saw his first military action during the Hungarian expedition, when the Russian government supported the Austrian government to suppress the rebellion in Hungary. Then, a couple of years later, he also saw action in the Crimean War. And after this, when he realized that the wars and rebellions in the West had subsided for now, he asked to be posted in Orenburg in the East, because he still wanted to make a name for himself. And war was the kind of thing that could propel you through the ranks of the Russian meritocracy. So he joined several expeditions. He was an explorer. He mapped the region. He was one of the first to study the Aral Sea, and he very much enjoyed his time in Central Asia, but afterwards he was posted in the Caucasus, where he was involved in the century-long Caucasian War, which incidentally also had a British element in it. The Circassian Rebellion was in large part financed and organized by the British. They were smuggling weapons through the Black Sea to the Circassians, and even the Declaration of Independence of the Circassian rebel movement was literally written by a British military advisor who was staying with them. So this was also a front in the great game in the end. Chernyayev had very ambitious plans. He had the mind of a conqueror, of an Alexander or of a Cortes. He sent his plans to St. Petersburg, to the Tsar's court, but Alexander II was not very interested at that time in aggressive expansion in Central Asia, so his plans were never really taken up. After his stay in the Caucasus, he was posted again in Central Asia. He took the city of Chimkent and once failed to take the large city of Tashkent. And at that time, he stayed in Chimkent. And that's when the most interesting part of the story really begins.
Tashkent is a modern capital of Uzbekistan, so take that into account. because at that time there was no borders to speak of course.
Yes, the Central Asian countries we know as Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan didn't really exist at that time. These are basically made-up Soviet countries with made-up borders, which were pretty random. And large parts of these countries had been Russian for centuries. Large parts were... it was basically like, you know, in Africa or the Middle East, when the European colonial powers just drew random borders on the map and said, yeah, so these are countries now. This is the same thing that the Soviets did in Central Asia. And they were making up ethnicities just so it would be more easy for the bureaucracy and so on. So, yeah, the Soviets were not really good at managing Central Asia. Chernaev, General Chernaev, was staying in Chimkent with his garrison. He was explicitly forbidden from trying to conquer Tashkent again. And he wrote letters all the time to the Tsar, to his superior generals, that Tashkent should be taken, that the expedition is very important, but he was rebuked. So one time, two things happened at the same time. The governor general of Orenburg, who was basically Chernaev's boss, he was due to arrive for an inspection of the Chimkent garrison, and he also got a letter from the Tsar. A reply to his latest plea to be allowed to take Tashkent. Chernaev didn't open the Tsar's letter, because if he had opened it, he would have been acting against direct orders. But if he didn't open it, he could just say that he missed the letter. And also, he had to move quietly before the governor general arrived. So Chernaev moved out with his expedition. It consisted of 8 companies of infantry, 2 sotnyas of Ural and Siberian and Orenburg Cossacks. The Cossack sotnya is basically equivalent to the Western squadron of cavalry. And 10 pieces of artillery. So all in all, just over 1,000 soldiers to take a city of 100,000. Chernaev moved out and quickly took the fortress of Nyazbek. Nyazbek is a small castle right outside of Tashkent, a couple kilometers away, and he stayed there while he prepared the attack on Tashkent proper. Chernaev's military engineers also diverted the local river away from Tashkent, so Tashkent would not be supplied with fresh water anymore, which was a pretty genius move, because he didn't have the forces to stage a large siege, but depriving a city of water is a very effective method of forcing their hand.
He wanted to start them total war style.
Yes. Leader of Khokan's religious faction, the very conservative, regressive forces, was a certain Mullah Alimkul. He was the de facto leader of Khokan. He was even more powerful than the Khan. And he decided to stage a large battle before Chernaev could even approach the city. So he moved outside the city walls to attack Chernaev's camp. Alimkul's forces consisted of 40,000 soldiers. 10,000 of them were regular European-style line infantry with modern uniforms, modern weapons, and trained by mercenaries, many of them British. And the rest were tribal soldiers, so, you know, nomadic horsemen and conscripted peasants, and so not very effective. But still, 40,000 against 1,300, these are pretty heavy odds. Alimkul also had artillery, and he commenced his attack on Chernaev's camp by bombarding it for hours with shells. And then he attacked. But the Central Asian armies were not very effective in battle, and Chernaev's forces consisted of grisly veterans of the Russian colonial wars, and Chernaev was also a military genius, so Alimkul's army was utterly destroyed within a couple of hours, and Alimkul himself was killed. This, of course, sent Tashkent into a panic, because basically all of their army was destroyed right away. So, as I mentioned before, the city-states of Central Asia. They were based in cities, but they ruled over large tribal lands, which were not permanently settled until the 20th century. Army mostly consisted of these nomadic tribesmen. The Emir of Bukhara sent his own army to save Tashkent from Chernaev, because Bukhara wanted to annex Tashkent also from Kokand. It was kind of an ongoing chess game between the three important city-states, between Khiva, Bukhara and Kokand, and all of them wanted to control Tashkent as the richest and most important city of Central Asia. So Chernaev found himself in a very difficult situation. He basically only went on this expedition on the expectation of victory, because as we had mentioned before in the beginning, ignoring your orders is all right, but only if you win. If you ignore your orders and you fail, this means shame, punishment, and chances were good that Chernaev would be sent to, maybe even imprisoned, but at least sent to one of the quiet, dead corners of the Russian Empire where nothing was ever happening and his career would be over. But at the same time, a military victory seemed pretty much impossible at that time. Chernaev had no soldiers for a siege, and a siege would have taken too long anyway, because the Bukharan army was already on the way. The defenders, the garrison of Tashkent still numbered around 15,000 people, so the defenders outnumbered Chernaev's troops 15-1. Chernaev saw no other chance than just taking the city by storm. He posted his soldiers. The worst thing was that he couldn't even use all of his soldiers in the attack, because he had to leave some soldiers at Nyazbek. He had to guard the river, he had to guard his rear, and less than 1,000 soldiers actually participated in the storming of the city. So on June 15th, 1865, in the dead of the night, Chernaev soldiers attacked from two directions. One had scaling ladders and were supposed to climb the walls and capture a gate to open it. And the other was supposed to be a diversion, so that most of the Tashkent garrison would leave the part of the wall that was being attacked by the soldiers with ladders undefended. Chernaev was very, very lucky, actually, because when his troops with the scaling ladders were approaching the walls, they found a sentry who was asleep. The sentry was in a weird part of the wall because there was nothing important there. So Chernaev deduced that he was probably guarding a secret passage. And they woke him up and forced him to show them the secret passage. And right at the same time, the diversionary attack began. So they could move without the Tashkent garrison being none the wiser. They scaled the wall through the secret passage and opened the gate. And then the attack proper began. It was probably a very crazy sight when 1,000 Russian soldiers stormed into a huge city surrounded by enemies, surrounded by the very dense Asian urban architecture, and led by a priest. The attack was actually led by a chaplain who was not armed and wielding a cross, Father Malov.
And this is where the free segment of our podcast ends. Just admit it, you are hooked, and you need to learn more to flex your newly acquired esoteric knowledge on a random art hole that you have a crush on. Free yourself from tedious American monoculture and subscribe to Russians with Attitude to get full access to weekly episodes from the forbidden part of the world. Thank you.